Welcome to the Business of Security podcast, episode number 9. Your host is Chad Beckman. Today, he will be talking with Bill Martin, Director of Privacy and Compliance at the New York Public Library. Now, let's get to it.
What does the industry need to start talking about that we're not doing today?
Information technology is built on a horrible foundation. If we could sort of redo and start from the beginning, we would be so much better off.
If you don't invest in it and keep it running, it will blow up.
You also have to be able to go in with solutions, not just problems. We have a long way to go if we're going to win this fight.
At the end of the day, educated people are really the best countermeasure against all the threats.
Welcome to the Business of Security podcast. This is Chad Beckman, and joining me today is Bill Martin. Bill, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Yeah, glad to have you. So you and I met in New York about a week or so ago, and it was my first time visiting the New York Public Library, and I got to say the institution is quite interesting and has a long history. You and I spoke about many different facets, we'd like to cover today a bit about the uniqueness of being a director of security and privacy for a nonprofit institution such as the New York Public Library. But before we get into that, I'd like to learn a little bit more. Particularly for our audience, a bit about your background and how did you get into the industry?
So, good question. Thanks. So it's interesting because for a couple of reasons. One is the position I'm in is unique in this country. No other library has a full-time privacy officer, chief privacy officer. And when the library initially thought about this position about 2.5-3 years ago, they were looking for somebody who had a library background, a compliance background, and a legal background. They were looking for somebody with an MLS, Master's of Library Science, a JD, a law degree, and compliance experience. And when they put together the job rec, some people said, you're never going to find anybody who's got all of that. And I had two of the three. I didn't have a JD, but I had the compliance and the library degree. So flashback to about 30 years ago, I started out working in libraries, in a public library. At the time, I didn't have a library degree. I came to New York back in the late 80s and attended Columbia University, which at the time had a library science program. And because I wanted to pursue that, I stayed working in libraries for about another 7 years or so. And then, no surprise, libraries are not exactly the highest paid profession in the world. So I was looking for something that maybe would use my expertise that I picked up working in libraries, especially in the technical end. I kind of became the guy that everybody went to set up their computers and install a new printer or whatever. So that led to an opportunity at a small firm called Prolifix, which does middleware development. From there, I went to Citigroup. I followed a colleague that I'd worked with there and worked at Citigroup for about 15 years in compliance and IT. And that led to actually senior level positions managing compliance for the entire institution. So working on policies at Citigroup, working with the OCC, Federal Reserve, FDIC, in terms of their compliance work and overview with the bank. Yeah. So I had a thorough vetting and versing in terms of the bank's need for compliance with industry standards. From Citi, I went to JP Morgan, worked there for a couple of years doing IT policy work, again, embedded in that sort of end of things. And then from there, that led to this position at New York Public Library. And I was really the unicorn out there. They didn't have anybody else approaching what I had, which was that marriage of library work and a background in compliance, especially what I would call the real world of compliance, where you've got federal regulators coming down on you who can shut you down if you're not operating according to the laws and standards. So that was late 2015. And as I said, I to this day, I remain the only person at any library who's doing this full time. That said, I can say the Smithsonian Institute did around the same time, a little before, also hired a chief privacy officer. So among the nonprofits, there are very few, and the person at the Smithsonian, Dan A. Gaines Adams, is probably one of the other few folks who does what I do in the nonprofit sphere. And that's kind of where things are at the moment. And I can go into what work we've done since late 2015 when I came on board.
Yeah, tell us about what it was like to be the first person to take on the role of security, privacy, compliance for an institution like the New York Public Library, particularly because many of our listeners can probably relate, being the first one in to establish, let's say, the kind of baseline and due diligence around a function that previously did not exist. You have certainly some culture changes, some training to do. So how did you get started? And tell us a little bit about that journey.
So when I came on board, one thing I should have mentioned is that I'm within the legal department. So I report directly to the general counsel of New York Public Library, a person named Michelle Mays. And even though I'm not a lawyer, I sit within the legal department. So that kind of gave me the authority, if you will, for what I had to do. And the first immediate task I had was updating the library's privacy policy. It dated from, I think, 2011, 2012, and had not been updated since then. So we're now talking 2015. And, you know, as those in technology know, in 4 years, the world can change, and it had. And so we needed a new policy that recognized the broad breadth of data that we collect in the library. So you mentioned the unique library environment. One of the things that was immediately apparent to me is that the idea of compliance, as I had experienced it in the banking world, where everybody was kind of on board with things like AML and Bank Secrecy Act and various regulators, the library world was completely removed from all of that sort of rigor and discipline in terms of data management. It's not to say that data was mismanaged, it's just to say that people hadn't thought about it in those terms of classic risk management and data classification and those kinds of things. So, and the thing I was mentioning to you, Chad, when you were here, is that what I often remind people of is New York Public Library, unlike, say, a startup or even a lot of modern tech companies, is an institution that came out of the 19th century. NYPL, New York Public Library, started in the late 19th century as a result of various private libraries coming together and in combination with Andrew Carnegie, who gave money to create some circulating libraries. And so essentially what we have is an institution that started in the 19th century, it grew up in the 20th century, and now we're trying to thrive and grow in the 21st century. But what we have are elements of that whole 120, 130-year history under our roof. So I'm showing you, Chad, a checkout form that we have for our research libraries, a two-part carbon copy form that we use in our four research libraries that we still use to this day because it remains the most efficient way of getting those books. So when somebody needs a particular book, that's the best way we have. So the point is that we have this whole analog methodology that sits within our realm, as well as the latest and newest digital innovations. So on the digital side, when I came on board, one of the things that was just being launched was something called Simply E. It was a platform, basically, it was an e-reader, similar to Kindle or others that you may have seen, but it was meant to be a platform that would allow our users to borrow books through this application that was rolled out through iTunes and Android. And so that immediately presents some challenges in terms of the data security and the privacy aspects of looking at that platform. We were also doing crowdsourcing on a couple of projects that were within our digital department, including we have these maps that date from 100 years ago, 200 years ago, and we were actually having people, just the public, come in and say, help us identify the locations on these maps. So we were kind of in that space of, you know, the really cutting edge part of digital and technology, while at the same time we have, you know, paper call slips and books and things that are, you know, thoroughly embedded in a 19th century style kind of information. But at the end of the day, what I constantly remind people of is data is data, whether it's on paper, whether it's digital, or whether it's something that you know. Mm-hmm. And that sometimes comes to the fore, you know, what librarians know. And so one thing that I was telling you about, Chad, that I think it, most of your listeners are probably not aware of, is libraries have traditionally been very responsible and protective of their patrons' information. So what you borrow, what you're looking at, think about somebody logging into the library and using one of our research databases. That activity, that information gathering that you do while you're at the library is within our scope protected. And one of the protections of that are actually laws on the books in all 50 states that say that library information in particular is protected and cannot be used for any purpose other than for library purposes. And these laws, interestingly, started way before the digital age. They came out of the late 70s and early 80s when, believe it or not, the FBI was going to various libraries. And think about the Cold War. They were asking libraries to help in identifying people who might be engaged in spying activities. And so that kind of prompted states to, like New York, to say, you know, people's activities in the library is important. In fact, in the New York State Legislature documentation back in 1981, they said libraries are a sacred sanctuary where people's right to inquire without fear of somebody seeing what they've done is essential. So that kind of isn't, you know, that paints what we do in terms of privacy within the library world. That traditional library aspect of protecting its users, these state laws, and just the expectation from our public that we are a safe space, to use a term that's kind of come into play. And I think as the digital environment evolves, we are even more responsible for making sure that people can come to us and say that, you know, I know that coming to the library, I can research a topic, and let's just take one that's kind of provocative, bomb making, right? And know that nobody's going to, you know, track me down and say, why were you researching that particular topic? And when I say tracking down, we think about, let's go back 17 years to the Patriot Act, right? And this has haunted more than a few libraries in terms of government authorities wanting to know what people are looking at in libraries. And there was a famous case in Connecticut, became known as the Connecticut Four. And it all had to do with a person who came into the library, used one of its public computers to tip the FBI off to somebody that they thought was a terrorist. The whole case involved the federal government issuing what's called a national security letter, an NSO letter, which basically meant that the library had to A, turn over the information, and B, not tell anybody about it. There was a gag order. That's a part of what an NSO letters at that point required. That's what Congress since changed that. But it was an example of how, you know, even in our current environment, we are facing that sort of inquiring minds wanting to know what people are doing behind our doors. And so we are conscious of that, and we're protective of people's right to have that free intellectual inquiry.
That's fascinating. Yeah, when I visited the Stephen Schwarzman building, where you and much of, I think, the historical foundation of the institution is, at least in that area. There's a number of different rooms with different themes and different content. So you have a research library, I know. You have the time I spent. I spent probably a good 90 minutes in the genealogy section or genealogy room of the library, which looking at how the Great Migration occurred from Europe back at the turn of the century or just before the turn of the century, New York probably has the richest catalog of that data. And I'm happy to say I actually found some of my ancestors' records, ship records. So your library contains an essential amount of research. And when we were speaking, you were bringing up even certain artifacts where I would almost say in some aspects you're part library, part research, part museum, based on all the content you guys have under that under your roofs.
So that's a good point, and we are a bit of a number of those things. I mean, people think of libraries, and I still see people, I'm at a cocktail party or whatever, and they'll say, "Oh, a library, or isn't that just kind of, isn't that out of date? I mean, what do people need libraries for? They can get everything they need on the internet." And the response to that is kind of a multiple aspect of what libraries can. What they are and what they can do. So, I mean, the immediate response is you probably don't know half of the things that, that the library has, even the average, say, mid-sized city library. I mean, so I sent you, Chad, a page where it just listed straight off 8 things that you can do with a library card without even leaving home. So, mm-hmm. A, you could borrow an ebook and read that at home on your computer or on your mobile device. You can read a newspaper. Thousands of newspapers are available online from the library.
Without subscription. Yeah.
Without subscription. You can read various magazines that you might normally have to subscribe to. Your library pays a fee so that you can do that free. Again, that you can do all these things remotely. We're not even getting into what you can do while you're here. Movie streaming, which is an interesting thing. We just engaged with a company called Canopy, canopy.com, K-A-N-O-P-Y, which has 30,000 classic films. They're mainly in the sort of cultural space, but these are available to watch for free with your library card. You can use tools like lynda.com, which I'm sure folks in the technology world are familiar with, teaching you skills on everything from how to use Microsoft Word to how to code. That's just kind of a small sampling. But then you mentioned the Stephen Schwarzman building where we have an enormous research collection. We have manuscripts, we have photography, we have, you mentioned the genealogy collection, a rare book division. And along with that, we have just the research side alone kind of establishes us within the what's traditionally called the research library. But added on to that, I mentioned Andrew Carnegie. He came along with a donation of about $5 million to establish a number of circulating libraries. So when you wrap it up, we have 4 main research libraries at NYPL, the one that has, I would say, the majority of the different types of things, photographs and rare books and those sorts of things. Those are at the Stephen Schwarzman Building, Midtown Manhattan. That's the famous building with the lions up front. Mm-hmm. But then we also have the Library for the Performing Arts. That happens to be situated at Lincoln Center. And that has an enormous collection of books, manuscripts, recordings relating to theater, all of dance, performing arts, film. That's number 2. Number 3 is the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture. That's up in Harlem. And then the 4th one we have is the Science, Industry, and Business Library, which is also in Midtown in the East 30s. So between those 4 research libraries, we have all of this extraordinary material. If you go to nypl.org/collections, you'll just see a smattering of what we have, including one of the things that people are always amazed about is our collection of digital images. We have almost 1 million digital images that are available for free download. And in fact, the city of New York, God bless them, they had a lot of empty space in their subway walls, and so they wanted to cover it with something, and they came to us and they said, you know, can we use some of these digital images? So if you come into New York City, Manhattan, and the boroughs, you'll see on a lot of subway walls these enormous images that have been blown up, and it'll say New York Public Library image. So, but that that's something that we worked on and released just a few years ago, and it's been a really big hit. You mentioned some of the treasures that we have. So just a couple off the top of my head here at the Schwarzman Building. The one that's the most popular is Winnie the Pooh. So we actually have the original stuffed animals that were the inspiration when A.A. Milne wrote the Winnie the Pooh books. And through a whole series of things involving the publisher, we ended up with them in one of our proud possessions. But we also have things like the very first printed manuscript of Christopher Columbus's letter to Ferdinand and Isabella, telling them about the discovery of a new world.
That to me was a shocking. When you told me that when we were visiting, I couldn't believe that. I would have thought that would have been in something like the Smithsonian.
I know and a lot of these have to do with what's called provenance. You know, who's given us collections over the years, and it's why any museum or library oftentimes has a collection. It's because a person has a relationship with us, and they've either sold or donated their collection. Most recently, for instance, we've purchased the archives of George Plimpton, who published the Paris Review. Tom Wolfe, the writer, we have his papers. Truman Capote, Lou Reed, the musician, we recently purchased his archive, which includes not just papers but recordings, demo tapes. In fact, I saw something the other day. The original, for those who may remember, the Velvet Underground, the original demo tape in a sealed envelope that Reed was going to send, and it's never been opened.
Oh, wow.
So just fascinating things that, you know, again, you have to kind of get your head out of the space of just thinking of libraries as books and think about anything that relates to human history and its evolution. So, and then one of the crowning pieces is a copy of the Declaration of Independence in Thomas Jefferson's own hand. So, folks know, hopefully, from their grade school history, Rick Jefferson was the one who initially wrote the Declaration, was then edited by Franklin and Adams, and then the Continental Congress at large. But he wanted a copy of the way it was written before it got edited. So he had his own copy that he kept aside with all of the provisions for instance, eliminating slavery and so on. We have that copy. We have a copy of the Declaration in Jefferson's own hand as he wanted it to originally to have been passed. So,
And that one's going on display, or it goes on display periodically. Is that correct for the public to view?
That is. So couple of different occasions. One is around the 4th of July. We've put it on display in the past, and people line up for hours just for a chance to see it. And then the other occasion where we bring it out is every year at also around Independence Day, we have a swearing-in ceremony for new citizens. We bring in the various government officials. We have a huge auditorium, and we actually have the ceremony for new citizens to swear in, and then oftentimes we'll have the copy of the Declaration there for people to see. Good news is that we are anticipating what we're calling a permanent treasures exhibit opening in 2020 that will display many of these items for the public to see on a permanent basis. Another one just off the top of my head is Charles Dickens's writing desk we have in the Berg collection. So
that's amazing.
Things like that are kind of talismans that people are fascinated by.
Let's take a short break and hear a success story from our sponsor, TrustMap, the business management system for security leaders.
Hey, everybody. This is Chad Beckman, CEO of TrustMap. And today joining me is Aaron Pritz. Aaron has spent 17 years in a Fortune 500 pharmaceutical company. Now he runs Reveal Risk. Given his background, Aaron provides a very unique perspective, having managed risk, compliance, privacy, and security strategy across multiple lines of management. Aaron, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
Can you give us a little bit of background information on how you discovered TrustMap and what you see that is really different about it in the marketplace?
Yeah, so I personally had a lot of, I would call it pain and suffering from GRC, and a lot of my industry colleagues had represented the same. So I initially found TrustMap in searching for a GRC alternative, or better said, an alternative to GRC altogether. And I kind of, I would say, accidentally found TrustMap and really found that it was everything I was hoping to get out of it, out of a GRC, but far more. So I would really use it to simplify both within clients that I work with now, or if I were to ever to go back to a corporate leadership role. I use it to evaluate security programs as well as privacy at the asset level, at the program level. I think it is a strong input into building an improvement strategy and being able to see where you are doing well and where you are not doing well. And then also measurement and tracking is one of the, I would say, no-brainer things, but sometimes hardest to do. And I think TrustMap provides a really good angle into being able to measure and track commitments against your investments throughout time. And then most importantly, it really provides a way to communicate all of these messages upward to both executive committees and board of directors with some solid visual aids and very simple ways to display progress, goals, and outcomes. And ultimately, you can drop $2 to $5 million over 5 years and a sizable staff to put in one of the legacy GRC offerings. But to me, I would just use TrustMap for most of everything I would need out of the GRC, and everything that GRC doesn't do, which is really a lot of the program and maturity measurement and management that really allows you to move the ball forward.
Great. That's a awesome feedback and perspective based on your experience in the industry. Is there anything else that you'd like to leave our listeners with in considering a solution to do their job better?
I would say focus on business risk. We're in a time right now where a lot of security programs are starting to get funding and starting to have to spend money. And that's not a bad thing. But I think without a plan, without a way to figure out where your risks are from a true business standpoint, not technology, which is a flaw that a lot of us face in the field. But I think really figuring out where you need to go, what you need to do to get there, how you're going to measure it, and know when you get there and what's enough is so critical. Otherwise, we will all drown in a sea of cybersecurity tools that are half implemented or not implemented. I think things like TrustMap are just a wave of the future, and we're going to have to, the future is now if we're going to rationally spend the money that we're getting, and most importantly, to reduce risk.
Thanks, Aaron. I really appreciate the input and feedback. Everyone, that was Aaron Pritz with Reveal Risk. And if you want to get a hold of Aaron, how can folks reach you?
Just go out to revealrisk.com, and all of our contact information is there, and would love to hear from you if you have any needs.
All right. Thanks, Aaron.
Remember, listeners of the podcast can schedule a free trial of TrustMap at trustmap.com/business. Now let's get back to the show.
Now, if somebody has not had a chance to visit the building that you are officed out of, the Stephen Schwarzman building, and also wants to get a brief kind of tour of some of the, different libraries and different rooms and so forth, because I'll say to the listeners, the architecture alone is worth visiting. And if you're into that kind of thing, which, you know, it's beautiful. They don't make buildings like this anymore. And, there's a video that I'd like to point people to, and it's on YouTube. How? What's a quick search they could run on a YouTube?
Let's see if they did. It was done by Architectural Digest as part of a series they do called In Detail. If you type in NYPL and Architectural Digest into YouTube, you'll get that as the first hit.
Yep.
It's called Hidden Details in the New York Public Library. Extremely well done. Great photography, mm-hmm. which we naturally expect from Architectural Digest. But it has one of our internal folks kind of leading the discussion. And one of the things the video shows are some of these treasures that I mentioned mm-hmm. that they brought out for the purposes of the video.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I saw that about a week or two prior to visiting, and it really enhanced my knowledge as I walked through the building and discovered different rooms and just looked at the unique design of the building itself. And so I encourage everyone, whether you have visited the New York Public Library or if you are preparing to or want to just know more about it and get a virtual tour, to check that video out. It was, like you said, Bill, it was very well done. Let's now kind of change course a little bit and get back to, you know, the some of your role in now protecting this really sea of information. You have certainly a lot of physical material, physical data, as we discussed, as well as electronic data. So, and you have privacy rules as well to address, you know, based on the description you gave with inquiries into individuals' research and what they've done or are doing and how that is protected at a state level. And you mentioned a law across every state. So that's a very dynamic environment, and it is, I would say, as complex in some regards as a large financial institution from those of which you've previously worked. So how are you balancing and perhaps even changing maybe some culture or mindset of the organization to think more critically about certain information, handling certain information, and applying the proper protections?
So thanks for the great question. So one of the things I had learned actually when I was at J.P. Morgan was, because I was working with IT policy, but we had all the various businesses, obviously, that were supported by IT. And as we worked on various standards and policies, it became apparent that there was a need for understanding and sign-off by the various stakeholders. So I kind of used that model when I came here, and I pitched it to Tony Marks and his direct reports. Tony's the president of the library, that we would form a privacy advisory committee. And this was kind of I wouldn't say the library doesn't have a lot of opportunities like this, but it was what I did was make sure that each of the C-level folks had a representative on this committee, somebody that they knew and trusted to bring information back. And we meet once a month and we talk about various ideas, initiatives, and so on. And one of the first things we did was come up with a plan for a data classification policy. We, as I mentioned, library kind of was a little behind the times in that area. The idea of classifying data as restricted, internal, public, and so on had not quite come to the fore here. So it was one of the initial things we worked on, and helping all people also understand the idea of data inventory, the risk management of data, you know, not treating everything as just something that you can swap between departments or with, mm-hmm. with whoever asks for it. So that was a bit of a culture change. But the committee, I think, helped instill in people the idea that, okay, well, there's this other factor we need to keep in mind now. And the thing also that I think is a challenge for libraries more than the for-profit world is because libraries have traditionally been at a squeeze point in terms of funding, I'll say, they've relied on outside vendors for a lot of what they do. So libraries, writ large, can't afford to create an internal database system to process much of what goes on there. So we, for instance, contract with a company for what's known as the integrated library system. It's the the system we use, when you check out a book and it keeps track of the fact that, that you, Chad, had checked out a copy of Winnie the Pooh, whatever, and it, you know, relates the, it's a relational database, and it's doing that work. But we contract with an outside company to do that. Another example is ticketing of events. We have a lot of events here at the library. Somebody wants to get a ticket to that. We use a company called Eventbrite and also a company called ShowClicks. But those are outside relationships. And so that became also a key point for me, is making sure that these vendor relationships are carefully managed, that we know what we're getting into when we sign a contract with a vendor. And I have to say, one of my victories that I point to is that as we touch base with especially the smaller vendors, we've pushed back and said, we don't want you to collect a certain amount of data. So I'll give you an example. One vendor came to us and they had very typical kind of splash screen, log in with your Facebook or Google account. And so I said, well, what information are you collecting when they click that link? Well, you know, Facebook logins are typically all your public information, mm-hmm. your name, your email address, all of your contacts, your gender. I mean, it's whatever you've designated on Facebook to be your public profile. And I said, there's no reason you need this. Actually, it was the company I mentioned called Canopy. And we, bottom line is, we negotiated with them for them to change their interface so that it wouldn't collect that information. Another company I worked with, another vendor, was ABC Mouse Children's Software. It teaches them how to, you know, spelling and reading and, mm-hmm. and various things. But their out of the box product had a login screen in it that said, you know, create an account. And I said, there's no need for each person coming into the library working on our public computers to have to create an account. This should be, you know, login free. And to our, I wouldn't say to our surprise, but to our, we were pleased by the fact that they agreed to re-engineer their front end page so that it wouldn't have that login prompt. Hmm. So what we're seeing with vendors is that there is a willingness, you know, if the conversation is right, for them to accommodate us and what we want. But I think it also feeds into the larger space of where not just the libraries are going, but where institutions globally are headed. And the elephant in the room is GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation, that is now official law in Europe as of May 25th, 2018. And so this is probably where our next big step is going to be. So I mentioned the privacy policy that had to be revised when I came on board. That was done in late 2016. But now we have GDPR, which kind of affects all of the things that I've been talking about, the collection of people's information, what I call the data life cycle. Think of, you know, information that you collect, where it's stored, who has access to it, where is and when is it transmitted, if at all, how long is it kept, and how is it disposed of, that entire circle. And GDPR kind of helps codify that whole set of behaviors. And so in my mind, this will help me with the library and just generally the nonprofit world at large say, this is what we're going to do. This is where we're going. I know the Smithsonian, we recently had a conversation with them. They're already on board with this. Of course, they have a much more international audience. But for those who don't know, GDPR is a set of regulations that has to do with privacy controls, things like consent, what's done with data, transparency, and many other aspects of data usage. And it affects people who are resident in Europe. Common misconception is that it applies to European citizens. Does not. It applies to anybody resident in Europe. So you, Chad, if you were living in London for a year, you would be covered by GDPR. You would have the rights under that law.
Even if I was a U.S. citizen, but I perhaps... Yep. Okay, so that would cover me if I was temporary living in London for a year.
Or even a month, or, you know, just on vacation for a week.
No kidding.
It is.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, think of it in terms of when you go to another place, another country, you're, let's say, in France, your behavior, what you do is subject to the laws of that country. So, just think of it in that respect. So it's a protection that you get rather than a penal code.
Right.
It's punishing you for something. It's something that's actually protecting you in terms of their laws. So one of the things where it gets complicated is, okay, well, that's for people who are resident in Europe now. What about the whole digital universe? Well, okay, you're in London, but you've got an NYPL card and you're connecting to our databases here in New York or wherever we have the servers. Are you covered by GDPR in terms of using U.S. institutions' resources? And the answer is yes. So GDPR, the three kind of tests are, you are required to abide by GDPR if you have a physical presence in Europe. So you're Google and you have servers and you may have facilities or even an office in Europe. Definitely. But then there's a second category. Do you have products or services that are offered to and used by Europeans? Okay, now we're definitely in that space. And the third test is, do you follow the behavior of people who are resident in Europe? And this is where I think the doors go wide open, because think of any website that any a European resident can hit, you're now in the space of GDPR control. Washington Post, I think, recently changed their paywall so that European residents would have to acknowledge that they, you know, were under a different domain or jurisdiction. But the essential thing is that we, given the breadth of our scope and the number of users we have throughout the world, are going to have to abide by this. So it's a good thing because at the end of the day, GDPR gives me all of those things that I had wanted to do when I first came on board, and now codifies them and says you must do these things. So that will be the next big push. GDPR requires complete mapping of data, so we'd have to know every piece of data that we collect, especially in the PII, personally identifiable information space. We have to know, remember that life cycle I mentioned, we have to know what's happening with that data, where it's being stored, who is using it, mm-hmm. how long are we going to keep it for. And one thing that GDPR does that I think will really hit home for libraries, not just us, is that there's traditionally been the idea of, well, we'll collect the information, we'll just keep it forever, you know, never know when you might need it kind of thing. And it's a benign sort of choice, but GDPR makes it very, very explicit that you cannot collect data, A, for a purpose that is not clear and decided up front. You can't, you know, say collect your name, Chad, because, well, we might use it in a marketing campaign in the future. We have to say that up front. And the second thing is that you have to know that we have that information and what we're using it for. And I think that's going to be one of the biggest culture changes, is that transparency aspect that GDPR will bring. So that's kind of in the next year or two where we're headed with privacy controls. And that will result in a newly written or revised, rather, privacy policy for the library. But again, we may be on the forefront. I don't know of any other library that's going down this path, but we certainly, as one of the, I think we, last I checked, we're the fourth largest library in the world in terms of its items that we have in our collection.
And I would say, based on you know, what I know, is you're probably one of the most innovative. We've had, you know, when we had met in person, we talked about an incentive program even that the library has to incentivize its staff to come up with new and innovative ways to serve the public and promote some of the information that the library has. So there's many things that the New York Public Library, I believe, is doing from not only a security and privacy standpoint that's very unique to that sort of organization, but also from a strictly innovation and keeping the library as an institution, generically, really relevant. And with that, I'd like to segue just briefly. Before we began the podcast, you mentioned about the upcoming 2020 census. And before we speak about that and your involvement, I guess, in some way, but I want to talk about the broadband, which really surprised me. So can you tell me a little bit about the library's role in supporting new broadband users, particularly in the greater New York area?
Sure. So there are a couple of things that have driven our decisions and work in this area. Among them is the New York City Mayor's Office has been very involved in trying to understand and remediate the issues with broadband connectivity. And I sent your chat a report from Mayor de Blasio's, Bill de Blasio's office that was the result of a fairly thorough study that looked at how many people in New York City have access to broadband. And the statistics are pretty staggering. I mean, overall, I think it's about 30% of the population in New York City do not have broadband access. But if you take a slice out of that and just look at people in at the poverty level or lower socioeconomic status, we're looking at over 50% of the people who do not have broadband access at home. And it's not just individuals, it's businesses as well who are affected by this. So to remedy it, the city has, to its great credit, started on a project to wire, especially housing projects, with broadband access. I was surprised to learn this myself about a year ago. The largest housing project in North America is one called the Queensbridge Housing Project, just across the river in Queens. For those who know the Queensboro Bridge, it's right on the other side of that. It's about 6,000 apartments. And the city is wiring all of them for broadband access so that people have Wi-Fi from their home and can do various things. And as we all know that we're at the point now in our history where without internet connectivity, there are certain basic things that people cannot do. And one of them is, for instance, apply for a job. It is, or collect certain kinds of benefits from the government. Those things require internet connectivity. Libraries across the country provide machines in the facilities, but if it's 9 o'clock at night and library is closed, what do you do? So it's that kind of access that the city has realized that they need to provide to people. So along with that, the city also said, well, we're going to need people who can answer questions that people have about this. Think about it. The analogy I use is somebody has a handsaw that they've been using, and all of a sudden they're being given an electric saw, circular saw. This is now empowering people to do things that they never imagined possible. So in response to that, the three main library systems in New York City, New York Public Library, we only serve three of the five boroughs, Queens and Brooklyn, have their own library systems. So the three systems got together, and we created a program to train our frontline librarians, the people there at the reference desk, to answer questions from people about digital privacy and data security. So when you think about the challenges that somebody who's never really used the web before might have, it's across the board. So things like logging into an account, what's two-factor authentication, what's a VPN? I hear that people can track me when I'm online. What do I do to guard against that? I got an email from somebody in Nigeria who wants me to transfer money because, email scams. These are phenomena that not, we may laugh and say, oh, well, of course, everybody knows about that. But this is where libraries in their kind of traditional role of helping people understand the world need to come up to speed. So we have an online training program. Queens of Brooklyn are actually going a step further and doing an in-class workshop in addition to the online training. And for the New York Public Library, it's about 1,100 of our frontline librarians who are going to go through this training. It's about 2 hours. And starting off with basically the real basics, how does the web work? Because we can't even assume that our own librarians understand that.
Sure.
And then getting into some of the technicalities and also the resources that they can point people to. And the thing I've emphasized about the training, I've been involved in this with the two other library systems, is we want librarians not to be like the geek squad. They're not going to be the ones to help you, you know, program your phone or actually do the settings or whatever. But they're going to be the ones to answer the questions, because libraries, and think about any kind of information you go into a library for, you know, medical advice, that sort of thing, we're the place you can come to get authoritative, up-to-date, and accurate information. And that those three things are where we excel. And so I think that's where we've landed with this program. The city is doing its part, and the libraries are dovetailing with this great new effort to get people online and help them do it safely. I was out at one of our branches not too long ago, and I asked the head librarian there, you know, what kind of reference questions you get, and I figured people were maybe looking for an encyclopedia or that sort of thing, and she held up her iPhone. She said, people want to know how to use this thing.
That's interesting. Kind of. In 2018, we're still seeing a lot of people are just kind of getting online with technology.
And as I say, it is vitally important. I ride the subway every day, and you know, everybody's on their phone. They're doing various things, or watching movies, or texting people, or whatever. But you know, the underlying things that are happening with those activities, I think, is what escapes people's attention. So, mm-hmm. along with this training that we've rolled out to our frontline librarians, the City of New York that has actually funded this training is sponsoring something called Library Privacy Week. And so it's actually started this past Monday. It goes through next week. And all three systems are having all sorts of activities. New York Public Library is actually having classes in a number of its branches. Queens and Brooklyn are doing various get-togethers, parties. Here's one at Queens Central Library called Antisocial, Exporting Your Google and Facebook Data. Find out exactly what information companies collect about you in this hands-on privacy workshop. Hmm. So these are the kind of things that, you know, I'd be the first to say we're only scratching the surface in terms of helping the public be aware of these things. But I think it's part of the library's traditional role to bring information to people. I mean, if you were to boil it down, what does a librarian do? They help you understand the world around them. And this is one of those things that we are hopefully going to be doing for people. And it's just all part of our greater mission. And we've expanded that mission. You mentioned, Chad, that, you know, we have a very innovative program. So we have, just in our education division, which is a division all in itself, we have adult literacy programs. We have, I mentioned, computer training. People come in and take classes on, you know, Microsoft Word or whatever. We have a whole career and employment division in our science industry and business library. We have after-school programs for kids can come in and learn coding, computer coding. I was just talking to somebody the other day. We're going to start rolling out maker spaces where people can learn to use 3D technology. Hmm. We're trying to stay, you know, up to date and relevant to what's happening in the world. And for those of you who have a chance to see it, there's a great documentary by a famous documentary filmmaker named Frederick Wiseman, and it's called Ex Libris, E-X-L-I-B-R-I-S, and it's the story of New York Public Library's current mission. Great movie. It's got wonderful reviews, and it's available on Canopy, so if you happen to have a subscription to that. But that documentary shows the kind of the full panoply of all of the things that the library is involved in. And the people who reviewed the movie for major newspapers said that the one thing they came away with from that documentary was, wow, I never realized the library did this. We have a public speaking program, for instance, which has some just fascinating guests from across the spectrum of arts, entertainment, technology. I went to one about a year and a half ago with Cory Doctorow, who's a writer, and he was interviewing Edward Snowden. Remotely, Snowden was dialed in from Russia, but you know, it's those types of things that we do, that we bring to people, that
That's amazing. And I'll make sure that I reference that documentary on the show notes as well, so folks can take a look at that and reference it. Bill, this has been extremely informative today. I really appreciate you sharing it. You alone, I'll use the analogy.
I am a one-person shop.
Yeah, you're a one-person shop, but you're a library of information on the library, quite frankly, and all of the moving parts that are going on within it. So I think you're really doing a great job representing and understanding the business of the library, which is what, you know, security and privacy leaders really need to do a good job. And so I commend you on that. I mean, you're doing...
Thank you.
Doing a fantastic work there. I want to appreciate you for your time and educating us on everything that's going on.
Well, and I am more than happy to talk to folks who might want to explore any of these topics more thoroughly. And certainly if anybody's in town at New York Public, they can give me a call or send me an email. Chad, you're free to put my email address in the notes, and it's an interesting evolving process. I'm looking forward to the next couple of years and perhaps having a conversation like this in 2021 or whatever, mm-hmm. and seeing where things stand. Mm-hmm. I think it's in the 2.5 years I've been here, it has completely transformed what I do, and that's a result not only of what I've done, but what's happened in the world around me. And I'll, you know, just say one word, and that will bring it into focus, and that's Facebook. I mean, what happened this past spring in the congressional hearings, I think, woke people up to what is happening in the digital realm around them. Mm-hmm. So I appreciate the opportunity to chat. Thanks very much. Great to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll be sure to, when that exhibit releases in 2020, I'm going to make a point to visit and see some of those artifacts that'll be set up permanently. I'm looking forward to that.
Definitely. No, I think it's most of the major museums in the world have something like that. And I think it's our turn is long overdue to show great things that we have. But that video that you're going to be posting will show something, give people an advanced preview.
Excellent.
So they should take a look at that.
Excellent. All right, Bill, thanks much.
Thank you, Chad.
You're back.
And hope everybody has a great day. And if you're in New York, give me a call.
Thanks for listening to the Business of Security podcast. A special thanks to today's guest, Bill Martin. Our host today was Chad Beckman, founder and CEO of Secure Digital Solutions. Connect with Chad on LinkedIn and learn more about Secure Digital Solutions online at trustsds.com. Our next podcast features Joyce Bricaglia, CEO of Alta Associates and founder of the Executive Women's Forum. You've been listening to the Business of Security podcast, and that's a wrap.